Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry. As our crisis series of the Alpha Exchange continues, I was pleased to have the opportunity to engage with Jens Nordvik, the founder and CEO of Xanti Data. After stints at both Goldman Sachs and Nomura, Jens launched his independent firm in 2016 with an eye towards using a highly data-driven approach to help institutional clients make sense of global economic developments and position portfolios accordingly. Our discussion focuses broadly on the notion of non-linearity as it applies to asset markets, a key part of the investment philosophy Jens utilizes to evaluate risk and highly applicable to the current landscape of virus-centric uncertainty. Harnessing new and extremely real-time data sets, Xanti Data was decidedly early in understanding that COVID-19 was going to be a big deal globally and that markets were failing to appreciate the risks. This disconnect and the potential troubles that lie ahead owe to the difficulty in appreciating the growth in processes like a virus that are exponential in nature. I think you will really enjoy this episode of the Alpha Exchange, my discussion with Jens Nordvik. My guest today on the Alpha Exchange is Jens Nordvik. He's the founder of Xanti Data, an independent firm that's focused on global macro analysis and complex data analysis. Jens, thanks for taking the time to join us today on the Alpha Exchange.
Well, thanks for inviting. It took a little bit of time to get a time we could both do it, but I'm glad we finally found a time today.
Well, just a greater evolution of the path of this very complex dynamic for global market risk. We'll have a bunch to dive into. Before we get our conversation started, it'd be great if you could just give our listeners a little bit of your background, how you came into the investment business, and then, of course, how you sought to start Xanti Data back in 2016.
I studied economics in Denmark for quite a few years, and then I spent a lot of my career at Goldman and Nomura in sort of sell-side capacity. So at Goldman, I was head of the currency strategy. And at Nomura, I was managing a broader research department with economics and fixed income research embedded. And in between, I had a shorter period at Bridgewater Associates, also focused on sort of macro currency analysis. So really what I want to do differently when I started Xanti in 2016 was to have a very data-driven research process. So we've invested a lot in building proprietary data sets and proprietary models. And just to be specific, we have a platform for tracking and forecasting capital flows that we're fortunate that some prominent asset managers, they use that platform intensively in their investment process. And similarly, when we do broader macro strategy beyond the capital flow dimension, we try to really focus on what is sort of under research. We don't spend a lot of time forecasting U.S. data releases or anything like that. That is very crowded space. So we try to focus on macro topics that are under the radar and where potentially there's some misunderstandings at play as well. Those are the best opportunities. That's where we can add the most value. So yeah, I guess one example from this year is the COVID stuff. So we just shifted our focus to that in January, when we thought that that was not fully appreciated, at least outside Asia, its relevance and sort of market driving potential. So that would be an example of that.
When you started in 2016, you had this vision of using data, which we're all awash in, I think, in a more effective way. I'm curious, even in the 4 years since you've been running your independent firm, maybe give us some sense as to how the availability of data or the capacity to harness unique data sets, even in that 4 years, have you seen a jump in the capacity to do new and interesting things from that standpoint?
Yeah, I think this year is totally extreme. Because of what has happened with the virus, we've had all these large data providers that normally have kept all their content secret that have actually made it available as a public service. So we have incredible data available from Apple and Google and many, many, many others that previously was not in the public domain at all. And it's been very powerful in terms of projecting the virus and projecting the economic impact. It's almost like we don't look at standard economic data at all, right? Because the alternative data is so leading to the traditional data. And on some of these specific things that we want to measure in relation to the virus, you literally have not just a sample of information, you just have the whole population. So it's just vastly superior to what you would get from traditional statistics. That is just a small sample that has all kinds of issues associated with it.
That's incredibly interesting. And I think it speaks to just the perhaps increasingly competitive nature of the business of managing money effectively, just the extent to which market efficiency is based on not just, as you say, the traditional data metrics, but increasing availability and then capitalizing on understanding new and complex data series. So we're going to talk a lot about COVID, but I think just as we dive into that, I just would be curious in your deep background in global macro, I always like to ask guests if there were specific events on the risk front that helped really define their philosophy around global macro risk events. And I see in some of your materials and how you think about markets, a focus on nonlinearity, a focus on the breakdown of correlation regimes. I'm curious if you can expand on your thought process there and if there are specific events in the past that helped really create that philosophy for you.
I'm thinking about the Euro crisis in 2010, 2011, 2012. I spent like an incredible amount of time thinking about the Euro crisis and future of the Euro and so forth. And did a lot of modeling also where we used peripheral spreads as a key driver. And what you learn when you do those type of models is how vulnerable to a breakdown they are, how dramatic and nonlinearity you have in some of these relationships. So we used a lot of modeling techniques. We used linear models a lot, but we used them more to sort of understand and dissect what's going on rather than something you actually trade, because trading space, the relationships are very, very nonlinear. So that's sort of fundamental insight. And obviously, when we think about what's going on now and what we've been through, we've seen that type of nonlinearity again now, because we had a situation where you could trade sort of the COVID numbers and the market tanked. And now we have a second wave in the U.S. to some degree, and the market is barely responding. So there's just examples of this all the time. But the nonlinearity is really important to be aware of and be afraid of.
These big risk events in markets seem to happen so much more frequently than any more traditional model might suggest. We know that the normal distribution is kind of widely used in terms of option pricing. Folks use it as a good starting point, but clearly the tails in markets are extremely fat, unpredictable in terms of timing. And this last burst in volatility brought the VIX to a new all-time high, and the market really was caught off guard. You can argue that the market didn't really see 2008 coming properly either. You could say in the sovereign crisis, there just was not a sufficient understanding of what was happening. But you guys seem to have an appreciation early on for the gravity of the situation in terms of the virus, even as it was widely considered an offshore issue, something that maybe China was dealing with, but not the U.S. What led you to that area of research, and what did you see early on that the markets just didn't appreciate?
We have a very, very global focus, and one of the areas where we spend the most time is China. So we obviously saw very early on that this was something that was moving Chinese assets around, and we got focused on it. And then we saw what policymakers did. So policymakers in China essentially shut down the entire economy for multiple weeks. And I think they were very aware of what was going on. It was extremely deliberate what they're doing. And we were just shocked to see that happening in one of the biggest economies in the world, and then other policymakers not take it seriously. It was just a bizarre disconnect. So we were incredibly worried about it. We launched a daily publication to cover COVID all the way back in January, because we thought this was going to be a dominant market theme. And I remember I did one tweet in early March when there were 60 cases reported in the U.S. where I just didn't understand. people are flooding in from Europe, and we know it's already rampant in Europe, and it was just an incredible misconception. So yeah, I don't think I quite experienced anything like that in terms of like just being super worried and market literally not having moved at all. So that doesn't happen every day, sure, but it did happen this year.
Let me ask you this, as we sort of piece together what occurred during a big epic risk event. We know the market experienced the massive sudden shock of both supply and demand, the self-imposed shutdown. And so, of course, asset prices are supposed to react. In the setup going into it, just in terms of the global economic backdrop, how would you characterize the kind of state of fragility that the economy and markets were in? What was on your radar screen outside of COVID in the, let's say, early January and February for global markets?
There's two points, really. So the first point would be that we had very close to zero interest rates in a lot of countries around the world. So a big monetary policy response was not easy, certainly not through interest rates. And the second thing was, I think, just a complacency. So investors have learned that most of the time in the post-crisis period, the worst thing you can do is to get scared if the market is down for a few days. You have to buy the dip. So I think in late February and in early March, there were a lot of people who were just very, very reluctant to get bearish because of that experience. And obviously, this was a very big shock, so it was right to be very cautious. But I think that sort of psychology of having learned that bearishness is costly was part of the reason why we then ended up with such a violent move during March.
And now we've got, of course, this ongoing challenge, but a pretty substantial recovery in risk assets. How do you kind of put all that together? Is it just the degree of Fed response? Is it more the government topping off the income side of things? Is it that markets got that oversold, some combination of it? When you look at the state of things now in terms of risks versus where you see asset prices, are there inconsistencies that you're focused on, or does it generally make sense to you?
Like a lot of people like to discuss these letters that you can attach to the type of recovery. We have V, U, L, whatever it is. And I think we do have right now something that looks like a V. The question is how long that V will last. And I think some of the work we've done in the last couple of weeks have a lot to do, okay, if we have some real problems in places like Texas and Florida, how important is that in the context of the places, New York, New Jersey, other important economic states reopening? And what you generally find if you sort of do that math is that it has to be very, very dramatic in those southern states for it to sort of derail the V in the short term. But once the V has progressed, and we've had the reopening in New York and so forth, then I think by August, it's going to be very different. And that's also the time when we will have to see whether the phase four stimulus has been put in place in a way that really shields income and consumption. And I think that's very, very different. So extrapolating the V into that period, I'm certainly not willing to do. We'll have to be very precise about what stimulus is actually coming through, whether it's sufficient, and obviously evaluate how far asset prices have moved. But normally when you have a recession, and I'm not sure you can even call this a recession because it's been such a quick period, but normally when you have a recession, you have some serious tension in the credit market. And clearly what the Fed has done on this occasion has been totally unprecedented in terms of shielding credit investors from any losses. So there are certain companies going bankrupt, but beyond that, the risk premium are really not that elevated, in my view. So the Fed has done something extraordinary on this front, and we've really never seen how that plays out to have like a big economic drawdown without any kind of credit fallout of similar proportion. So that's something that we'll have to navigate and see how that plays out. But I don't think there's any doubt that the lack of credit market fallout has clearly boosted the economy, but also dramatically boosted valuations in credit and equity space. And I think that is really important for thinking about how the equity market is going to evolve from here.
There's a lot of commentary on what the Fed should do or should not do, and folks get outraged as to the view that the Fed is wading further into private markets and determinant of outcomes in a way that they had not previously. When you look at the interventions from the Fed, do you see longer-term consequences? Are they on the right path here in terms of trying to work through this incredibly difficult period, not just for markets, but of course for the broader population? Are there any side effects that you're concerned about?
The Fed's job is to essentially keep people employed if it doesn't generate any inflation. So from that perspective, it makes a lot of sense for the Fed to be very, very aggressive. And I think in terms of the specific things they announced and the timing of them, I think they did a fantastic job in terms of avoiding market meltdown, dysfunction in the market, and so forth. I think the best example is probably like when bonds started to sell off, the QE amount was so enormous that it only took a few days for them to really regain control of the bond market. But the question is whether there's going to be a price to pay, because we are front loading the asset returns and we are generating a lot of liquidity, and it's clearly influencing credit. It's clearly influencing equities. It's probably going to influence real estate and other assets as it sort of migrates through the system, the dollar over time, gold and so forth. Everything is interconnected here. So the longer term consequences is that we've front loaded these returns and then there's going to be a bunch of returns missing in the future. Obviously, what the Fed is doing is not just something that is a total zero sum game, because if they can avoid the economy being damaged, then there is a net gain to be had, and therefore it's the right thing to do. But it does leave the question about, okay, the people who are going to save in the future, what kind of returns are they going to be facing? And this is an area where we're moving into unprecedented territory, really.
One of the things is so interesting about these big risk events is that you get some massive shock, asset prices fall really fast, the VIX skyrockets, and it seems to demand some intervention from the central bank at each turn. And that intervention seems to be even larger in scale and scope. And now you have a situation where in order to try to help clean up the mess, the government is going to be issuing more debt than ever in terms of the deficits that will run. So the Treasury's financing needs are through the roof. And they're issuing this paper at the lowest rates we've really ever seen. So you've got long dated, let's say the 10-year decidedly at maybe not minus 50 basis points on a real interest rate basis. How does that all fit into your analysis of where we're going? Just the massive amount of issuance of government paper at what seem to be unappetizing prices, at least that's my view. How do you sort of fit in the supply side of paper into the mosaic of risks?
I think in these situations, it helps to study a lot of different economies around the world. So Japan is a country that has had a large fiscal deficit for many years, have a very large government debt, has really never had any issues selling that debt. And it's very interesting to sort of look at actually what Japanese investors are doing right now. So we spend a lot of time on a day-to-day basis tracking capital flows. Japanese investors have been big buyers of U.S. fixed income this year, including very recently after the bond yields reset to very low levels, way below one in nominal terms on the 10-year, they're still buying. So they have an experience of having lived with close to zero bond yields for a sustained period of time, and they're okay with buying these bonds. So I think that tells you something. It tells you something that we can be in a very, very low yield environment for a very long period of time, unless something totally fresh happens on the inflation front. But the ones that have been through this type of experience are the ones that are buying a decent amount of bonds now. So I don't have a view that we're going to move to a higher yield environment anytime soon. But I think the question is, the countries such as US that have both a fiscal deficit and a current account deficit, so they rely more on external financing, do they have to pay a price, not necessarily on the yield side, but in terms of the currency side, in order to attract that? So that's the really the big question, the currency market. Are we going to have like a big dollar move? And we can have a multi-day podcast if we're going to go into that. But just to mention a few things, the global growth trajectory there is really crucial. If you have these type of financing questions in the U.S., big issuance, big current account deficit, in addition to the fiscal deficit, you would expect the dollars are generally trade weaker. But the variable that is often missing in that equation, that is a dominating variable, is what is going on with global growth. So in a rising global growth environment, the dollar then does tend to weaken if you have those domestic issues as well. And therefore, it is absolutely crucial for the dollar whether you have something that smells like a sustained recovery globally. That is going to be the dominant driver of the dollar and really the determining factor as to whether you're going to have a big structural dollar move over the next year or so as a function of the policy shifts we've seen.
You and your team spent a lot of time on China, and at different points in time, the currency relationship has been pivotal. There's been, at times, really strong correlation between changes in CNH and VIX. We had that period in 2015 that imparted quite a shock to the risk spectrum. What's your view on that, just in terms of U.S.-China tension from a leadership standpoint, the trade tensions? How should we think about that currency relationship? Are there underappreciated aspects of that risk that you guys see and are focused on?
Well, so we're definitely very focused on that. We've had real-time models of capital flight from China that we've been using and have been very helpful to understand what's going on in China since 2015, really. I think the message from those models this year is that while the virus started in China and we had a lot of tension around China, we never got to a point where there was dramatic capital flight from China, and the currency has been relatively stable. So the big ups and downs in the currency have really been a function of trade tension that now appears to be on hold. But nevertheless, I think the key thing to watch is whether we can have an escalation in that trade conflict. And the one thing that is, I think, a concern in that regard is what's happening in sort of U.S. politics. So we have a president now that is facing deteriorating opinion polls. And therefore, I think there's an increasing probability that various policy initiatives will be tested to try to turn the tide on those polls. And you have to question whether the China attack could be one of the ways to turn that tide. And that would then be a major risk for dollar CNH and potentially for global equity markets. So I'm not saying this is a central case, but it's certainly a risk factor to be very aware of and potentially hedge for.
Of course, China is included in EM and it's the biggest one, but there's a whole spectrum of emerging market countries out there, perhaps not with the same firepower as a U.S. central bank or U.S. fiscal response. What's your take on the health or the risks in EM in a COVID world? What areas of the globe concern you? Who's doing well in terms of combating the COVID crisis?
I have certain client discussions where if I use the term EM, people will say, can you stop talking? Because they don't want to have you talk about EM as like a one asset class. And I make that mistake sometimes myself. But I think especially this year, the differentiation within the so-called EM universe is just incredible. We have countries such as Taiwan, South Korea, where their management of the virus has been world-class. They've avoided a big hit to their domestic demand as a result of that. And therefore, there are some very good reasons for them to see outperformance. And then you have other countries where they came into this virus shock in a very poor constellation, and they're doing fiscal expansion from a very bad starting point. So Turkey is one example. Brazil is another example where the fiscal situation is very problematic. And yeah, again, when I look at Turkey, it looks like when we add up all the numbers, they essentially have literally negative currency reserves. So they're intervening to support the currency, but they actually don't have any foreign currency on the balance sheet anymore. So they're intervening with borrowed money, right? So this is really some quite extreme situations you're getting into. So we have to be very, very differentiated when we think about EM. And I think there's some of the Asian countries that are weathering this better than anybody else. And then we have some countries where balance sheet issues are really severe, where you have to think about sovereign risk, currency crisis dynamic. So you have the whole spectrum here.
Some of that differentiation would seem to rest on the degree to which the economies are oil dependent And I'm curious, just as you surveyed the tumult, let's put it that way, in energy markets this year, I thought an 83 VIX would have been pretty unique to note, but minus 40 or so print on a futures contract in crude was probably even more astounding. What's your take on just the backdrop for energy? And does that figure in a significant way to your calculus on global growth prospects and maybe country specific prospects?
So we've been through some ups and downs already on energy. So we had a global shutdown, pretty much totally unprecedented, that took energy demand down in a historical way. And now we're seeing some recovery. And the one thing that's interesting about the recovery is that it's not just following the broader recovering in the economy, but it's probably going beyond that because a lot of people are very afraid of public transport. So they're going to use their own cars essentially to move around, and that's going to boost energy demand. So there are lots of moving parts on the energy front. I think the other thing that's going on is that there are some of these producers around the world that are higher cost that are going to be disproportionately impacted. So when you have a big hit to price, it's not just, okay, everybody will take a hit that is proportional to the price decline. There are some producers around the world that are going to be entirely priced out of the market. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why when you look at the credit space, there's some of these logical defaults that you wonder, are they going to be delayed because of all the support that have been put into place, but will be ultimately unavoidable? I think those are the type of dynamics that are going to play out over the next 6 months as we get a better sense of really how sustained the damage is for those higher cost producers.
I know you've done a lot of thinking and have written some pieces on Europe. And of course, we talked about the Eurozone crisis. And to a large extent, that was a crisis of confidence in some ways about the leadership being able to come together in a pan-European way and backstop the region as a whole. And hopefully you can share with us your current thinking on that post the Merkel-Macron kind of summit. What are the implications of that? Is the market fully appreciating the significance of what's going on there? How do you see the developments there?
So back in the euro crisis, I actually wrote a book about this topic. It's called The Fall of the Euro. So the basic key point of that book was that some important backstop infrastructure was put in place in the eurozone that meant that we were not going to just have a financial crisis that took the euro down. They had enough kind of insurance built in for 2012 to avoid that. And I think that thesis sort of generally held up in the period up until this year. And now we had such a big shock that the insurance mechanisms that they put in place back then were not quite sufficient and we needed something else. And that's why this recovery fund idea that was tabled by Macron and Merkel was very important and rightly moved markets, because it was just a new signal that it was not just a central bank that was going to do the heavy lifting, but there was going to be some meaningful fiscal element to keeping the eurozone together and the EU together. And we've had a lot of discussions with many people, and you can criticize what they have proposed, the specifics of it, like maybe the amounts were not quite as big as they should have been. Maybe the timing of it is not quite as fast and other things. But I think the important thing from a signaling perspective is that Germany, for the first time, is really proposing to transfer a meaningful amount of money to specific EU and Eurozone countries in need. And that's a big shift for the most important economy and the most important political power in Europe. And therefore, I think it's something that's relevant for how spreads are going to trade in Europe, how the euro stocks are going to trade. And we've seen some of that since May 18. And now we have some important summits pending where we'll see if it's going to be formalized in a way where we can get some more sustained moves out of it in the market.
I remember when Draghi was in his last month or so, he had a pretty important public appearance, and he must have used the word fiscal many, many times in terms of trying to create the conditions for the handoff, so to speak. And maybe it seems that every central bank would love that, to be able to try to take away some of the extraordinary policy accommodation that's become almost normal these days. But do you see a scenario in which the fiscal takes on more and we're not with a negative 50 basis points or even lower deposit rate for the ECB? Is that a scenario that is in your sort of potential outcomes? Do you see that as possible?
I think one thing that's very interesting about what's going on in Europe is that while the experience with negative interest rates, negative deposit rates is a very mixed one and certainly not like a home run success. At the same time, we now have this situation where they're subsidizing the loans to the banks in an aggressive way. Nobody's really complaining about that. So this is a policy tool that can really be used to force lending pretty much. And again, like people who've studied economics, they've never really heard about this idea like literally paying people to lend. And that doesn't have the same limits associated. We always like thought, okay, if interest rates are negative, at some point people are going to move to cash, and therefore there's going to be a limit to how negative we can go before it's actually going to be very negative for the banking system. But if it's done through a subsidy for the bank lending, it's something that's different, and the cost of it is different, and it could actually be a very powerful tool. And I think that's what you're starting to see. We've had very big take-up in terms of these LTROs recently. So that gives actually policy ammunition in a way that should give us some hope. So that, I think, is something that's perhaps not appreciated sufficiently, something that's very important. And now I'm afraid I forgot to answer part of your question. So please repeat it if I can ignore half of your question from before.
It was really about an environment in which the monetary essentially ceded some of its influence and the degree that it was operating to the fiscal.
Obviously, in Europe, you still have a very complex setup where you have fiscal policy in different countries. They're trying to centralize a part of it now in the EU budget, but still only a relatively small part. So I would say that debate is more of a debate for big unified countries such as the United States, the UK, Japan, where we've seen it in all those economies. You have fiscal expansion go hand in hand with the quantitative easing or other forms of liquidity injection. So the line between fiscal policy and monetary policy is definitely getting more and more blurry. And I think now a lot has to do with, okay, what's the time frame over which these policies will be maintained? If you're maintaining these types of interaction between monetary and fiscal, then you really have a more sort of explicit form of permanent monetization. And obviously, a lot of people have been warning about inflation as a function of QE since 2008, and everybody who's been warning have been wrong, but we are trying it on a scale that we've not tried before. And as I said a little bit earlier on, certainly for asset prices, something that's highly relevant. It's going to take a long time, I think, before it migrates into goods price inflation, but we are getting to quantities where you have to think about those issues being potentially in play. So that's something that's very interesting, something we've not really been facing any time before. So each crisis creates some new questions, and that's really one of the big ones that is on the horizon. Not for tomorrow, not for the next couple of weeks, but if you think a year or two ahead.
Yeah, that's been an asset that really hasn't delivered for years and years, is being long some breakout in inflation. And I think it's a great and open question. And as you point to, the degree of policy response necessarily is enormous, even by 2008, 2009 standards. So it's a open question as to where things will go. This has been a great conversation, and I wanted to see if we could wrap it up, kind of going back to where we started and where some of your firm has really differentiated itself in terms of focus, which is on COVID. As we're in this period where the U.S. is trying to reopen, and there's definitely some unwelcome data, as you think about the next couple of months, what are the things we should be watching in terms of developments? Are there sort of markers that would make you feel especially good or optimistic? And then on the opposite side, what would you worry about when it comes to the reopening and COVID?
So I think in the next few weeks, we can be very confident that we're going to have a significant acceleration in cases in places like Texas and Florida. Because the behavior that has generated the outbreak we've seen over the last couple of weeks, which is not just about testing, that some people say it's not just about testing, that it's a real outbreak. That behavior has not changed yet. And there's a lag between behavior and cases. So it's kind of baked in the cake
that we'll have further acceleration for the next 2 to 3 weeks. So then the big question is, okay, are we going to start to see behavior change in the next couple of weeks, which will then translate into a different trajectory in July? And we've looked at a lot of alternative data. Some of the data that we find most helpful are some specific metrics of restaurant activity. That's a form of behavior that is relevant, and it can be used as a proxy for how relaxed the population is overall. So I would expect those indicators to show more caution in the next couple of weeks, and that then should take the transmission rates down, and then we can have a more controlled growth in July. But if that doesn't happen, then it's going to be a big wave, and then I think the hospital pressure will become relevant. Hospital pressure is already increasing from a low level, but increasing fast. And I think we've all learned, including policymakers now, that processes that are exponential in nature, you really have to be careful about looking at a level of the variable now. When there's some exponential growth in play, that level could look totally different in 2, 3, 4 weeks' time. So watching whether behavior changes now in the next few weeks is crucial. I think people will get scared. I think people will start to be more cautious, in which case it's going to be a more moderate growth that the hospitals can cope with more easily. But that really is a crucial differentiator between getting into a situation where we face a dramatic problem or a manageable problem by the end of July.
Outstanding framing. And of course, we come back to the non-linearity aspect of it, which is especially vexing. Jens, I wanted to thank you very much for your time today. This was an excellent discussion, and congrats on the success of your firm.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to the Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again, and catch you next time.